This week on Making Contact.
I don't really think we'll fix our dysfunctional food system unless we start fixing our democracy. And we have to fix our democracy.
From farm to fork, few things matter more than the food we eat. We all want the freedom and opportunity to choose what ends up on our plate, but when a handful of companies control most of the brands you see at a grocery store, what choices are really left?
Over the last 20 or 30 years, these companies have become exceedingly powerful. They've become so powerful that they're able to actually dictate food and farm policy.
On this edition, Winona Hauter, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch and one of the nation's leading healthy food advocates, says it's time to turn the tables on big agribusiness. I'm George Lavender, and you're listening to Making Contact.
I grew up on a farm, and I've always cared a lot about food and farming issues. I am one of the lucky people because my father bought a working farm. I own a farm with my husband, 45 miles from Washington, and a very large urban population. And so he's been running it as a community-supported agriculture program since 1997. So one of the things that I've learned, though, living on a farm and also working at Food and Water Watch, is that farm policy isn't set up for farmers. And if we're going to really change the food system, it's going to take more than just local agriculture. And so there were really two incidents that drove me to write Foodopoly, even though I'd been thinking about it for a long time. So I was in the Midwest in 2010 at a food-related conference, and I was writing an article and was talking to many conventional farmers about what it was like to grow corn and soy in the Midwestern United States. And one of the farmers started telling me the sad story about his family's farm. He'd had this farm and his family almost 160 years, and now he was just not able to make a living any longer, and he was either going to lose the farm because he had mortgaged it, or he was going to have to sell it outright. So after I left that very sad interview, I went and I sat in on this conference, and I was listening to a food panel, and it was about organic food production. And the person who was talking was asked a question by someone in the audience about why is organic food so expensive? And her answer was, well, it's because farmers are getting subsidized. And then she went on to basically call farmers greedy welfare queens. Not in those words, but that was the basic lesson that she was giving. And, you know, that's a really confused answer. It misses many, many, many steps along the way. So I decided to write Foodopoly to answer some of these mythologies that we have amongst people who are trying to change the food system, and because I think we really need to generate a discussion and a debate about the deeper structural issues that are the problem with our food system. So let's begin with some statistics. And you know what Mark Twain said about statistics? Lies, damn lies, and statistics. And that's surely the case when you look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's statistics. Now, they claim that today there are 2.2 million farmers. Well, let's look at those numbers. They define a farm as the very smallest farmer having sales of under $1,000 a year. That's a third of farmers. Then, two-thirds of farmers have sales of under $10,000 a year. So who are these people? Well, they're like my good friend down the road who has a vineyard. He sells about probably around $10,000 of grapes a year. He's retired military, has a very good off-farm income, moved to the country to grow grapes because he wanted a vineyard, always dreamed of having a vineyard. He's really not a farmer. So because the USDA counts these people as farmers, hobby farmers, these entities with very small sales, it makes it look like there are a lot more farmers than there actually are. Probably the USDA is doing this because they're embarrassed and ashamed about how few farmers are left. When you actually look at how many farmers work full-time on the farm using their labor, it's under 1 million farmers that we have left. And of those, only 115,000 are the very giant agribusiness farms that probably use contract labor, that have thousands of acres that they use to grow commodity crops. So what does this mean? This means when you look at who is getting the subsidies, 82% of full-time farmers get subsidies. And small and mid-sized farmers all get subsidies. And the typical income, the average income, is just over $19,000 of a full-time commodity farmer. And half of that comes from this government subsidy system. So truly something is wrong. But what happens if we just get rid of the subsidies and we don't change the structure of the food system before we do that? Because no farmer wants to have to depend on a subsidy system. What happens is already happening. These small and mid-sized farms are going out of business. And what happens then? This 115,000 really giant farms buy or rent the land of these smaller farmers. And it means more and more and more consolidation. This isn't what we want for transitioning our food system. We want to save small and mid-sized conventional farms. We want these farms to be part of a new food system. We want to convert these farms in the future to organic production. We want to join with farmers to create a new food system, because let's face it, how can we have a new food system without farmers? So how did we get in this mess? I want to go back and talk a little bit about some farm history. So everybody knows about the New Deal and that the U.S. was in really terrible economic shape. In fact, the banks and many of the corporations of those days were using the same bad policies that have brought on the economic problems today, the recession and so forth. So when Roosevelt came into office, one of the things that he wanted to do was to help bring up the income of rural people, because at that time, 54% of Americans lived in rural areas, and most were engaged in farming, and farmers were not making a living. They weren't making the cost of production. In part, it was because of things like the Dust Bowl, of environmental problems, but it was also because of overproduction. So what the Roosevelt administration did was they passed a farm bill, and it had some programs in to prevent overproduction and to raise the income of farmers to be on par with the rest of society. It was like a minimum wage for farmers. Now, this worked really well through World War II. Farmers' income was raised, there were enough crops, there wasn't price volatility. But after World War II, there was an effort by some of the economic and business leaders in the country to undo this farm policy. And they had a number of reasons for wanting to undo it. And so these men got together, and they were men at this time. It was people like the president of Studebaker, the head of the Kodak company, an individual who was an expert in the new science of public relations. They put together an organization called the Committee for Economic Development. And the goal of this organization was to frame the economy of the post-war United States. And part of their agenda had to do with the rural community. They wanted cheap labor in factories, and especially in areas where they needed skilled labor, people to train, to be in manufacturing. And they were concerned about so many boys coming back from World War II and going back to the farm and being farmers. These men also had a political agenda, it turns out. It was not just cheap labor, although cheap labor was certainly an important part of it. These were the business leaders of the day, and they knew their history. They knew that rural populations in the U.S., farmers, had been the vanguard of the populist movement since after the Civil War. At that time, farmers were fighting banks and the railroads and all of the economic interests that didn't allow them to make a living. And these farmers had joined with other social movements like labor. They had elected candidates. They had become very, very politically powerful. And so these leaders of the Committee for Economic Development were concerned about what would happen when these men came back to their communities that were now enjoying a very high standard of living and that were very interested in an advanced society with benefits spread throughout the citizens of the country. So I'm not suggesting that this is some kind of wild conspiracy. This is simply people of a class who socialized together, who strategized together, sitting around talking about what kind of world they want and having the wherewithal to begin fighting for it and lobbying for it. So foreign policy didn't change very much in the 1940s, but by the 1950s, the Committee for Economic Development was gaining traction, and the whole idea that farm communities should begin training their young men to go into other industries had taken hold. Even the USDA began publishing documents talking about how one-third of farms actually produced most of the food and that we needed farmers to go into more productive work, and that's a quote, productive work. So this began a snowball effect, and every farm bill after that began to kind of chip away and to reduce the programs that made it possible for farmers to make a living. And the intent was to replace labor with chemicals and capital. And this is how our industrialized agricultural system began to be built. So by the mid-1990s, after the U.S. joined the World Trade Organization, there was pressure to get rid of the rest of the programs, the vestiges of the programs that had benefited farmers and allowed them to make a living. This was during the Clinton administration. It was just after the U.S. joined the World Trade Organization, just after NAFTA. And a lot of promises were made about how terrific this would be for the food system, how great it would be for farmers. The bill was called Freedom to Farm. And it was very shortly after that farmers renamed it Freedom to Fail, because especially for the commodity farmers, they felt the pain before the fruit and vegetable farmers. 2 years after the bill became law, that would be 1998, the price of corn had plummeted 50%. The price of soy had gone down 35%. There were farms going out of business. There were wild fluctuations, but mostly the food processors, the grain traders, they were getting their heart's desire, cheap commodities. So there was a lot of political pressure on members of Congress. Rather than doing something that would make sense, like reinstating some of these programs that kept prices from fluctuating, Congress did what it does best. It spent taxpayer money as an emergency payment to farmers so that they could actually stay in business, but the price of commodities like corn and soy would be low, and that meant that there would be these companies that would really benefit. By 2002, these payments had become permanent, and the subsidy system was born. Now, obviously, our food system was broken before the subsidy system, but today, farmers are still not making a living even with the subsidy system.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Like what you're hearing this week? Well, we've just begun an investigative reporting project looking into corporate influence on food policy and the political process. Check out our website, radioproject.org, for updates. We now return to Winona Houter, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch and author of Foodopoly.
So I want to ask you all, we need some audience participation. So I'm going to ask everybody to stand for a minute. So sit down if you've had a Pepsi, a Gatorade, a Tropicana, Lipton Tea, Sierra Mist, Mug's Root Beer, Amp Energy, ever. Not today. I'm not the food police. Sobe Drinks, Naked Juice, Captain Crunch, Quaker Cereal, Aunt Jemima's Pancakes, Puffed Wheat, Rice-A-Roni, Lay's Potato Chips, Sun Chips, Cheetos, Tostitos, Cracker Jacks, Hickory Sticks, Doritos, Ruffles, I could go on. Those are all Pepsi products. And Pepsi is the very largest food company in the U.S. Nestle is the second largest company, but the largest company in the world, and Pepsi is the second largest company in the world. These are some of the companies that really benefit from these cheap commodities and who have grown more powerful and richer because of this system. So there are about 20 companies that control the food system. These are companies like Kraft, like Tyson, General Mills, ConAgra, Cargill. And so when you go into a grocery store, you think that there are many, many brands, but really there are 20 food companies that control 60% of the brands in the grocery store. And when you look at the relationships and the corporate interlock, these companies share 436 different board members. So the point is that over the last 20 or 30 years, these companies have become exceedingly powerful. They've become so powerful that they're able to actually dictate food and farm policy. And I mean, let's think about processed food. The American diet is comprised mostly of processed food. In fact, 90% of Americans' food dollars are spent on processed food, 90%. If we wonder why people are getting sick and overweight, that's largely why. And these companies also control most of the laws around the things that we're exposed to, whether it's pesticides or other chemicals, labeling laws. They're just extremely powerful. So this kind of consolidation is really detrimental to our food system, and we see this kind of consolidation from top to bottom. So the retail industry is actually driving the consolidation that we see all through our food system, with Walmart being at the top. In many markets in this country, one or two of these companies will have 70 to 90% of the market. They basically control the market in groceries. And when you have that kind of consolidation and you need that kind of volume, it really impacts the whole food system. So let's talk about Walmart. We all like to talk about Walmart. One out of three grocery dollars ends up in Walmart's pockets. And to just give you an idea of how vast their wealth is, their heirs have more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans. That shows you how much economic and political power this company has. And Walmart really stands alone. It's not just their size and their market power. It's the way they control the whole food processing industry because of their requirements for their logistics. So if you are a Pepsi or a Nestle or a Tyson, even you must bow to the requirements of Walmart because Walmart is such a big part of your business. So Walmart is really the most powerful food company in the country. They control these processors through their requirements for their logistics. The processor has to use their IT system, their packaging requirements. Contracts are non-negotiable. Everything about Walmart is about sucking all of the profit all the way from the farm to the Walmart store, and they're very, very successful at it. I think one of the biggest mythologies is that somehow Walmart is going to magically re-regionalize the food system, which we have heard some advocates say. I think it's very naive. Walmart needs volume. They, for instance, buy over 1 billion pounds of beef every year. When I went to visit the Central Valley of California to try to understand how the fruit and vegetable industry is operating, Walmart has had a detrimental effect on even the largest fruit and vegetable farms. The consolidation of the packers and shippers has been driven by Walmart and because of the global trade agreements. It's not just Walmart, though. It's when you look at organics, many people feel, well, you know, we're going to grow ourselves out of this from the bottom up. And with the organics industry growing and with even Walmart buying organics, surely things are on the mend. But the problem with these large companies and Walmart is, and all of the food processors that are into organics, is that they're in it to make money. They're in it as a niche market. They don't support the values underneath organics, and they have been busily over the last decade trying to weaken the integrity of the organic label by allowing synthetics into organics, by allowing antibiotics to be used in fruit production, by allowing chemicals in infant food. There are lots of ways that the organics standard has been weakened a bit. These companies that are just in it because they view organic food as a niche market for wealthy, educated people who will pay more. I mean, this is not the long-term vision that we had for organics. The top 20 food companies that I talked about, the top largest food processors, of those, 14 of them own the most prominent organics brands, the brands that you'll see where you when you go into the food market. And this is one of the issues around the integrity of organics. And one of the things that I think that we have to think about in why it's important that we start raising these issues around antitrust, because what kind of food system do we want in the future, and what do we see the role of organics being in the future? And that's really why I wrote Foodopoly. I think as someone who benefits from the local food movement, I think it's terrific. It's wonderful for everyone who participates in it. It's great to go out and visit the farm. It's great when a city like Seattle tries to figure out how to do food hubs and to support local food. But if we really want to change the fundamental problems in the food system, we're going to need to do more. And people are going to have to vote with their fork, as many people are doing, for their own good health and to support local agriculture. But we need people to vote with their vote and then to hold these elected people accountable. And that needs to begin on a lot of different levels and across the country, because we have a tremendous history of organizing in this country, organizing for social change, and we have to have the long view. Look at some of the big fights. Took 50 years to outlaw child labor. Look at how long it took for African Americans to get the vote or for women. It's only those vested economic interests, those multinational corporations that want us to be apathetic and to think there's nothing that can be done and the problem is too big. So I'm excited about all of the young people organizing, about all of the energy. And this is about winning back our democracy. I don't really think we'll fix our dysfunctional food system unless we start fixing our democracy. And we have to fix our democracy. I think that getting food activists involved in the larger political debate, getting rid of Citizens United, doing some of the things that need to be done around corporate personhood, all of these things work together, and we have to take hope, and we have to look at the big picture. It's a long road out there, but I know if we work collectively together, that the people united will not be defeated. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Winona Houter, author of Foodopoly. Thanks to Pirate TV for use of the recording. For a CD copy of this program, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Here at Making Contact, we always want to hear what you think of the show. Here's one of our listeners.
Hi, I'm Linda Sudak from San Francisco, and I'm just want to say to Making Contact, thank you so, so much for bringing me so much news and information that's both local and international. I really appreciate the variety of the contributors and the variety of the voices that I hear in the programs, especially all the ordinary feet on the street people who are able to talk about their perceptions of what's happening in the world and give their opinions of what's going on.
And we want to hear from you too. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.